You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, our coverage continues with the race to the Elysee Palace. We'll be joined once again by Christine Ockrent for the latest campaign analysis. We'll also assess why Aquascutum, the brand that fitted everyone from celebrities to soldiers, is drowning, while its rivals Burberry have stayed waterproof. And as women are finally allowed to join the Afghan military, we talk to a director of a new film which documents the struggles associated with being a female soldier in such a male world. All that plus a song or two and a culture chat with our own editor Rob Bound. That's here on Midori House, here on Monocle 24. So all that ahead in the next 60 minutes. Before that, let's get the latest headlines from Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The war crimes prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, has arrived in Tripoli today to continue investigating charges against Muammar Gaddafi's detained son, Saif al-Islam, sought for trial by the International Criminal Court. The Hague-based court issued an arrest warrant for Saif al-Islam last year after prosecutors accused him and others of involvement in the killing of protesters during the revolt that eventually toppled his father. However, Libya has insisted he will be tried in his home country. Upon arrival at Tripoli Airport, Moreno Ocampo explained why he was in Libya.
I'm here because I'm still investigating crimes. I'm going to Misrata because basically we're doing some investigation that we like to go there to see places. And also we are still prosecuting Saif and Sanusi, so we're still collecting evidence on them. And also because we had a mandate to investigate all the crimes committed here, we like to see what Libya is investigating.
The United States has today warned its citizens in Nigeria that Islamist militant group Boko Haram might be planning attacks on the capital Abuja, but the Nigerian government dismissed the alert, saying it would create undue panic. Boko Haram, who wants Sharia or Islamic law more widely applied across Africa's most populous nation, has killed hundreds in gun and bomb attacks this year. The NATO Secretary-General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has today said that the cost of financing Afghan security forces in the long term may amount to as much as $4 billion a year. Foreign combat troops are set to withdraw from Afghanistan at the end of 2014, with Afghan security forces supposedly ready to take over the responsibility for the overall security of the country. Rasmussen said NATO countries will reach agreement on how to find the $4 billion for Afghanistan after 2014 at a Chicago summit next month.
A long-term, sustainable size of the Afghan security forces will be equivalent to a bill of around $4 billion a year. And that figure has also been endorsed by the Afghan authorities and the international community in the local relevant bodies in Kabul.
The wife of a jailed Bahraini activist on hunger strike has accused Formula One supremo Bernie Eccleston of ignoring her husband's plight ahead of Sunday's controversial Grand Prix in the troubled country. Khadija Al-Musawwir said today that she supported Bahrain having the race. However, she said that the 81-year-old Formula One boss had missed a chance to do something to help the pro-democracy movement and her husband Abdul Hadi Al-Khawaja. 100 days ahead of the Summer Olympic Games here in London, British embassies around the world have organised mock 100-metre runs involving Olympic athletes. In Berlin, crowds gathered for an event at the city's landmark Brandenburg Gate involving two Olympic athletes, a local politician and a member of the British embassy staff. The race was started by the British ambassador, Simon MacDonald, who said it was important to mark the final countdown to the Games.
The Olympic Games are the most famous sporting event in the world, so I don't think they need much publicity, but it's just a reminder. It's only 100 days. I mean, you've got to mark your calendar, mark your schedule and make sure that you see all the events you want.
And finally, a canine cable channel in San Diego, California, has today launched online and is heading for national distribution, according to the channel's executives. Known as Dog TV, the advertising-free programming on the channel is aimed at stay-at-home dogs to keep them entertained and stimulated when left unattended for long stretches of time. The content on Dog TV is scientifically tailored for four-legged audiences, with even the sound, the colours and the camera angles adjusted to make them more appealing to canines. And those really are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Jonathan. Quite keen to know what a stay-at-home dog is as opposed to a go-out-to-work dog. 5 minutes past the top of the hour here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosan.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House. The time is just creeping up to 6 minutes past the top of the hour. Well, round one of the French presidential elections is just 4 days away. The broader picture today has perhaps been obscured by focuses on the smaller details. The headlines, for example, in the country's left-leaning papers already postulate on who will be part of François Hollande's new socialist government. Nicolas Sarkozy, meanwhile, has been defending his record with Europe by saying the word growth features at least 6 times in the EU fiscal compact. Some could argue this is petty nitpicking, others just another day on the French campaign trail. But could both candidates be missing the point, namely attracting those on the political margins, such as fans of the far-right Marine Le Pen? Well, to help us find our way through this, we're joined on the line now, again, by Monocle 24's French election commentator, Christine Ocant. A very warm welcome back, Christine. Lovely to have you back on Midori House. I mentioned just then Marine Le Pen, the head of the Front National, very much pushing Oui la France.
Yes, Marine Le Pen is conducting an interesting campaign because she had a double problem. First of all, she had to dissociate herself and her party from her dubious father's image. At the same time, she had to do so without discouraging the faithful. On the other hand, she had to fight back Sarkozy's tactical move, Sarkozy having indeed oriented his own campaign very much towards the extreme right themes. Marine Le Pen is a talented woman. She's eloquent, energetic. She is a lawyer by trade. She knows how to use words, which is always important, you know, in France. And I think she has managed to sort of eclipse Papa, and she has also managed to push Sarkozy even more to the right. Because the problem with Sarkozy is that he's tried to reproduce his victorious campaign 5 years ago, but he hasn't managed to win back those very people who feel so desperate about their own condition that they look for a protest vote. And to protest, they go to Le Pen or they go to the extreme left. You have a sort of interesting and very worrying volatility of people who are so angry that they would vote either on the extreme left or on the extreme right. And Marine Le Pen has indeed taken advantage of that.
Marine Le Pen was quoted a few days ago as trying to channel the country's anger against Sarkozy. But do you think she has actually rendered the Front National less toxic by possibly putting herself as an anti-system candidate, by protecting French sovereignty and the national identity, taking France out of the Eurozone, cutting immigration, doing all the things that will strike chords with certain French?
Well, I think she has tried to get away from the traditional Front National extreme right themes, you know, obsession with immigration and really, close to racist theories. She has walked away from that, and she's tried to be serious on economic issues. But that has been really not a success, because when she talks about getting out of the euro, sensible people, you know, soon get to realize that it's just not feasible. So when Sarkozy handled very well, actually, you know, these massacres in Toulouse and Montauban 2 or 3 weeks ago, Sarkozy gained back his presidential stature at the time, and then Marine Le Pen felt compelled to stress again the traditional themes of the extreme right, that is to say immigration, the dangers of extremist Islam, and so on and so forth. So she has come back to the traditional themes.
She's taken a risk, though, today in an interview with the Associated Press by saying that there's no shame in fighting the so-called Islamization of France, but at the same time insisting that this won't breed a mass killer. And she quotes the Norwegian Anders Behring Breivik. I mean, she's taken a big risk by mentioning him, even in her campaign.
Yes, but she had well prepared, questions about that issue by saying the guy is obviously totally crazy, and there was also a crazy guy from the Green Party who shot in a town council in France 5 or 6 years ago. But I think she tried to preempt that argument, about the Norwegian indeed defending himself using fairly similar themes, except of course in a totally crazy and murderous way. And I think she did it on purpose to use that argument, because she very well knew that it would be used against her.
Nicolas Sarkozy has said in an interview that voting for Le Pen serves his nearest rival, François Hollande. Is Sarkozy, for the first time, behind in the first round opinion polls? Is he really on the back foot here now?
Well, I think, Sarkozy is indeed losing ground. And as always, 4 days ahead of the first round, you have, particularly in the media, acceleration for the guy who is first. And so all the comments are very detrimental to Sarkozy, the more so as there may be, I think the first round will be interesting, and probably more so than is actually predicted. Not that Sarkozy has any chance to distance himself vastly from Hollande. He will not have a sort of 6 or 7 points. He won't be ahead by 6 or 7 points. But what will be interesting will be indeed the fringe candidates. And that will, of course, decide of the arithmetics for the second round, even though for the second round there is far less volatility and voters have been steadily announcing they would elect Hollande.
There's been a second blow to Sarkozy as well, because his predecessor, Jacques Chirac, has said he will back François Hollande.
Well, Jacques Chirac is a very old gentleman. He's not in good health. And it's actually his biographer, a writer who had written Chirac's memoirs a few months ago, who said that Chirac would vote Hollande. The former president himself has not spoken out, but his daughter, Claude Chirac, who is very close to her father, did indeed declare publicly that she would vote for Hollande. However, Madame Chirac, Chirac's wife, is a staunch supporter of Sarkozy, so it's a sort of torn family.
Let's turn now to François Hollande, the closest rival to Sarkozy, now taking the lead in both the first and second round opinion polls. He's come out by saying that he'll not endorse the EU fiscal compact if it fails to promote growth. This was what Sarkozy was building his great European reputation on. And now Hollande is saying, actually, I don't really want it if it doesn't really help us. Do you think that will help or hinder Hollande in the fight?
Well, I think that all these serious issues, frankly, have not had a great impact on public opinion. I think it's tactical. Hollande wants to convince his supporters that he will be strong facing Madame Merkel. But when it comes to facing realities on the 7th of May, then they'll have to go to business. And it's all very nice to say he would renegotiate. My assumption is that he will do exactly what Lionel Jospin, a former socialist prime minister, did at the time of the Maastricht Treaty. He asked for an addendum to that treaty about growth, and so the addendum was indeed acted, you know, and there was another chapter about growth, and that was it. But I think the whole European issue will be a major one for Hollande and his team if and when they get to the Élysée.
Christine, you mentioned there that issues such as the EU fiscal compact aren't impacting on public opinion. What is?
Well, that's a very good question. I think we live, in an age of emotions, of social networks, tweets. People, young people particularly, are very undecided or change their minds. You know, who is the guy whose image pleases me most? I think the image issue is key this time around. There are a lot of complaints about the fact that this campaign doesn't deal with the real problems of the country, but in a way the French don't want to hear about the real problems. They also, you know, they love to hear about dreams, like Mélenchon, the extreme left, who sort of resuscitates a kind of Marxist utopia, which has been dormant in this country, and which he managed to revive. I think that, again, it's more about perception, it's more about image, it's more about feelings. Do I like this guy or don't I like him? And, is he trustworthy? There's no great enthusiasm. There's no great enthusiasm for Hollande, although, again, his victory has been predicted for months.
Christine,
I was told by a friend of mine who was in a mass meeting of Hollande last night in Lille, in the north of the country, Lille being the kingdom of Martine Aubry, who might be his prime minister. People go there and they think, okay, it's done, and we'll see what happens. But it's not a vibrant campaign, let's face it.
Christine, as ever, thank you very much indeed. It's a pleasure to have you on. And we'll be talking with Christine Ockrent again tomorrow for another update on the campaign. It's just coming up to 18 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. In a moment, we'll be getting some music. And after that, the designs of the Olympics. Stay with us.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone. And now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films, and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound, and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis, and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
A And you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. It is just 20 minutes past the hour. Time now for some music. This is Jamie Woon and Nighter. That was Jamie Woon and Night Air. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. All this week at Monocle, we've been covering the lead up to the Olympics, which begin in 100 days' time from today. And on Midori House, we'll be taking a little bit more of a design focus on things. While the London logo and mascots have not been greeted with, let's say, wild enthusiasm in some quarters, the London 2012 Velodrome and the London 2012 Olympic Torch are both up for awards given out by the Design Museum here in London. The winners of the Designs of the Year awards will be revealed on the 24th of April. To talk about why they made the cut as nominees, we're joined now by a curator at the museum and one of the co-curators of the awards this year, Gemma Curtin. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Gemma. Were you by any chance persuaded or helped into your decisions of including these designs because they were Olympic related, perhaps?
Well, the designs are not nominated by us, but we have nominators, sort of scouts from every continent who gather information about new developments and products and talents in the seven categories. So it was one of the shortlist, but we were really delighted and very much well deserved. The Velodrome and the Torch are both wonderful designs by British designers.
So let's look at the Velodrome first. It's billed as one of the more sort of the long lasting permanent fixtures on the Olympic site. It's incredibly ecological, very simple. What was it that attracted you to it?
It's a beautiful, simple, organic form, and the form sort of echoes the form of the raked, sort of swooping cycle track. And the designers look to the rigour and the engineering of bicycle design for their inspiration. So it is a sort of light building in every way. There's no extraneous clutter. It's also very, as you said, sustainable. There's natural daylight, natural ventilation system, and this beautiful western red cedar which clads the building and reflects, as I mentioned, the cycle track, which is also wooden with it's made from pale Siberian pine, and it was installed to sort of millimeter precision by specialist carpenters. But it's incredibly simple and striking, and a very modern building as well.
I mean, when you look at it, and actually when you see the competitions that have been taken, that have been held on this track, and they have been fast like no other track before, how much does that actually contribute to the decision as to whether it is a winner or not? Because actually having seen it in action and seeing it actually doing better than anyone expected.
Well, I think that was very much one of the aims of the building, to create a track that would be record-breaking, and they seem to have done that. I think the designers must have known the possibilities of British medal winners and would hope that they produce a building that would be up to that, to be a noble and something that you'd be proud of.
Moving also now to the main icon of possibly of the Olympics, which is a torch. You have one of these torches at the Design Museum, don't you? Can you describe it to someone who hasn't seen it up close?
Yes, we have one in the museum. We had the it had just come out of manufacturing when we got it. It's triangular profile, made of sort of gilded aluminium alloy skin with sort of 8,000 small circular perforations. And these represent the 8,000 torchbearers who will carry the torch around the UK. It was designed by London-based designers Edward Barber and Jay Osgoby. And there's an awful lot of symbolism in the form. The triangular form is easy to hold. It's very practical. But also the three seems to have been a good number, in the sense that this is the third London Games. There was a Games in 1908 and 1948, and so this is the third Games, and also the Olympic motto, faster, higher, stronger, has three words. So the gold colour also represents the flame. The aluminium is lightweight, but also heat resistant. So a huge amount of detail again. And I think both these designers were incredibly proud and honoured to be designing for the Olympics. And I think you feel that and that energy and that really sense of patriotism that's gone into the designs of these two beautiful and modern things, trying to design something that wouldn't be seen as a traditional, but actually would be seen as a modern and forward-thinking.
And also incredibly British, because I think it's East Londoners who designed the Olympic torch, Barbara and Osgoby. They beat, how many, was it 500 rivals to the prize?
Well, I think, yes, it was hotly competitive. And I think they are very good designers, and they've really done a great job.
What is the torch up against in its category? Because surely there can't be many other torches. So forgive me for asking a very gauche question.
Yes, as one of the awards, it comes strangely under sort of the product category. So there's anything from a wheelchair to lighting to a mine detector to glasses. So to a thermostat. It really is a very, very a wireless speaker, the Jambox, an invisible cycle helmet. So it's incredibly across the board and broad selection of design. The Designs of the Year awards and accompanying exhibition, we try to show really very much the best of current design and really sort of the breadth of it as well.
Gemma, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Gemma Curtin from the Design Museum here in London. You're listening to Midori House. It's just creeping up to 30 minutes past the hour.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Du lytter till Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 no gigan des.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Você está escutando a Monocle 24.
Sie hören Monocle 24.
Acute Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
Coming up later in Midori House, we'll see what our editor Robert Bound has to say about what's happening in the world of culture this week, and we'll also be talking to the London-based tailor and designer Timothy Everest about why one classic British brand is going bust while others are raking in the profits. Before that, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Thanks very much. The war crimes prosecutor Luis Moreno Ocampo has arrived in Tripoli today to continue investigating charges against Muammar Gaddafi's detained son Saif al-Islam, sought for trial by the International Criminal Court. The Hague-based court issued an arrest warrant for Saif last year after prosecutors accused him and others of involvement in the killing of protesters during the revolt that eventually toppled his father. The United States has today warned its citizens in Nigeria that Islamist militant group Boko Haram might be planning attacks on the capital Abuja, but the Nigerian government dismissed the alert, saying it would create undue panic. Boko Haram, which wants Sharia or Islamic law more widely applied across Africa's most populous nation, has killed hundreds in gun and bomb attacks this year. The NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen has today said that the cost of financing Afghan security forces in the long term may amount to as much as $4 billion a year. Foreign combat troops are set to withdraw from Afghanistan at the end of 2014. The wife of a jailed Bahraini activist on hunger strike has accused Formula One Supremo Bernie Eccleston of ignoring her husband's plight ahead of Sunday's controversial Grand Prix in the troubled country. Khadija Al-Musa said that the 81-year-old Formula One boss had missed a chance to do something to help the pro-democracy movement and her husband, Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja. And 100 days ahead of the Summer Olympic Games here in London, British embassies around the world have organised mock 100-metre runs involving Olympic athletes. In Berlin, the race was started by the British ambassador, Simon MacDonald, who said it was important to mark the final countdown to the Games. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Time now to find out what's been catching the eye of our culture editor this week, Robert Bound. Earlier today, I spoke with Rob and we talked music, art and a particular problem he has with a chair in one of our studios. Rob, tell us about your cultural week.
My cultural week, I wanted to tell you about Patrick Keeler's exhibition at the Tate. It's called the Robinson Institute. And Patrick Keeler is a strange and interesting, quite wonderful man.
He's frankly baffling. Tell us, before we go into the exhibition at the Tate, tell us about the Robinson films.
So Patrick Keeler's, it was an artwork as much as a documentary. It's sort of a film essay that Patrick Keeler made. He made three called London, Robinson in Space and Robinson in Ruins. And these are three films, these are sort of hour-long film essays that are narrated, and there's no one stars in them. They're simply shots of different places. The two first ones are about London, and there's a narrator describing a journey with this fictional historian and sort of writer and polymath called Robinson.
We never see Robinson, do we?
We don't see him. He's a bit like Godot in Ways of Godot. He's basically sort of the film is spent sort of chasing this sort of imaginary character around.
And Keeler is a man who's he's trained as an architect, wasn't he? Into architecture.
Yeah, yeah.
He's big into urban planning. And so he sends Robinson to these randomly decaying places, doesn't he?
Yeah, yeah. He's the sort of person that will find as much beauty in a sort of decaying tower block as he will in an ivy-covered wall, or as much beauty in a kind of housing estate as in a cathedral. So he's this sort of. It's this idea of Patrick Keeler is a fine artist as much as a student of architecture. So he's a bit, and he's one of these people that is a bit of a psychogeographer as well. He's a bit of an Ian Sinclair. He's a bit, and also his film style sort of is slightly similar. It's didactic. It's a bit similar to someone like Jonathan Meade. These sort of strange. Sort of people that are halfway between cartographers and essayists and documentarians.
I think Ian Sinclair said of the documentarian.
Who was a documentarian? If I weren't so low down in my seat and had a bit more general confidence, I wouldn't have said that. I'm going to hoist myself up.
Would you like
a bit.
To stand?
Yeah, no,
hang on a minute.
It's fine. I don't think the mic will go. The mic won't go up high enough.
Right, down I go.
All right.
Okay.
Well, we're equals now.
We're equals now.
There we go.
Where were we? Keeler.
So Patrick Keeler, yeah.
Ian Sinclair has said that Keeler is the epitome of the part-time man. What does he think that means?
I think he's possibly the gentleman amateur is what he is. Yeah, he's like is an intellectual ghost. He'll do a bit of this, a bit of that. And that's why. And so the Tate are staging this show called the Robinson Institute. And the catalogue for the show is called The Possibility of Life Survival on the Planet, which when I asked to know more about Patrick Keeler and about the show, the Tate sent me this book, which is a proper book. So it's not a... This is the sort of thing that you get with it, a proper hardback book. That's the catalogue that comes with the show. And basically, the Tate have delved into their collection, have found things with the help of Patrick Keeler and the curator to try and investigate these strange films and the strange world of Robinson, which is a sort of idea of London in decay. And the nominal theme of it is exploring London's love affair with capitalism. That's sort of what it does. So these films.
So it's how the landscape has changed in response to or has brought capitalism into being or into.
Exactly. There are things where he says that. Things in the film where he says. The late Paul Scofield, the great Shakespearean actor who narrates London and Robinson in Space. There's one bit in it where he says he's convinced that London Transport. The government are using London Transport as a weapon against Londoners who are making a last-gasp desire for freedom, last-gasp kind of grasp for freedom. And it is that thing. So it's all this kind of... There's a lot of political stuff in it, but it's not errantly left or right or very obvious. But there's a lot of kind of distrust of political largesse and all this sort of
stuff. What is it? Is it film or is it just is it audiovisual? What is it in the exhibition?
The exhibition, the film Robinson, I think it's Robinson in Ruins, is screened in its entirety, which is sort of on a loop. But it is, as you know from having seen these films, Emma, it's that sort of thing that you can sort of dip a toe into and sort of see the themes of it kind of uncover themselves really quickly when you sort of watch the film, despite the fact we might be making it seem kind of mud clear. But
well, I was going to say the catalogue that you handed to me a little while ago to say this is about the exhibition. I found it as baffling as anything I'd ever opened before
in
my life.
It's sort of amazing because you read one page of it and there are things where he'll look back and he'll present a sort of a town plan, or he'll present the 1795 amendment to the Settlement Act, which allowed people that lived in the country, it allowed them to move to the city,
to go
and work in the cities, and this is how the Industrial Revolution happened, all the rest of it, or it's a product of it. And then he'll put it next to an artist's or a painting of the largest meteorite ever to hit somewhere outside of Leeds or something. So these are all these kind of subtle analogies that make up this picture of Britain and this sort of, as I say, it is this strange putting together of things. It's like W.J. Sebald's Rings of Saturn. He's kind of like, he's almost a man who sort of seems to walk London in a fugue, like Ian Sinclair described the poet John Clare as sort of escaping his lunatic asylum and walking to the coast of Kent in his pyjamas. You know, it's this sort of strange thing where you know it's brilliant, but and you can't quite put your finger on it. But the Tate have done it in a wonderful way to try to bring things from their own collection to illustrate this errant genius, I'd said Patrick Keeler.
Well, that was our best attempts at describing something which I still find utterly baffling.
Yeah, all I'd say is if you're in London, go and see it. Look him up on the internet, Patrick Keeler, and you can find these films on YouTube. But I'd suggest the BFI have just handsomely reissued them on DVD. So check them all out and go and watch them because they are absolutely wonderful.
So that's our trip to the Tate sorted.
So that's that.
You're out and about now for some music.
Later on, I'm going to go and see Catherine Williams' new band called The Pond. Catherine Williams is from Liverpool. She's a sort of folk pop pioneer. She's kind of been doing it for quite a while, and I think this is maybe her fifth or sixth album. This is under the guise of The Pond, and it's from a record of the same name. It's out at the end of May, so we're getting a bit of a sneak peek. Someone else, I think, has leaked this track onto the internet, so I don't feel quite so bad doing it. This is a little bit of a departure. It sounds a little bit like something that she might have made with Saint-Étienne, and this track is called Bebop.
Hopes the beat is on record, set for skimming 16 leaps as if he's still 16 and keen, but lo behold, he's 6 past 50.
And that was Bebop by The Pond, ending my quick chat with our culture editor Robert Bound. And Patrick Keeler Robinson is on at the Tate Britain until the middle of October. Stay with us on Monocle 24 because in a moment we'll be finding out how tough it is in the trenches in the fashion world.
May's Monocle is a well-behaved, waggy-tailed issue that looks at how Japan's passion for poodles and miniature pooches has generated a St. Bernard-sized business sector. We also get a preview of how our cities will look in the future at the world's most important real estate fair, talk soft power with the Goethe Institute, and find a hood to call home in Buenos Aires. And there's much more.
In affairs, we go on patrol with Brazilian troops in Haiti, visit a trio of twin cities, including Malmo and Copenhagen, and we take an in-depth look at the policies and style of China's new leaders.
In the design section, we head to the island of Tasmania and drop in on the tight-knit group of craftsmen for whom preservation, not progress, is the driving force. We also visit a new, perfectly formed shared living concept in Harajuku, Tokyo.
In our Olympic Icon series, we go to Kabul to meet Afghanistan's only Olympic medalist, the Taekwondo champion, Rahula Nikba.
There's also our 36-page travel guide to Thailand, our annual design directory, and Monocle's Helsinki City Survey. The May issue of Monocle is on newsstands now or available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The time is 18 minutes before the top of the hour. You're listening to the Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, on Monocle 24. We turn now to tales of feast and famine in the world of British traditional fashion, because two of Britain's most traditional fashion labels have found themselves at different ends of the financial spectrum. Burberry has announced a rise of 17.1% in its revenues, reaching record sales of more than £1 billion. Aquascutum, however, has gone into administration. Where Aquascutum once dressed everyone from soldiers to celebrities, it now risks becoming a brand relegated to the back of English wardrobes. Well, to tell us more about Aquascutum's woes and the success of Burberry, we have the quintessential British tailor, Timothy Everest, in our studio. Your sales have gone up by 20%, though, I wonder. So many congratulations to you, Timothy, but a very warm welcome to Midori House. Before we talk about Aquascutum's woes, what made Aquascutum so great?
Firstly, thanks for having me here, and you've obviously been speaking to my PR because it's not very British to talk about or boast about your increase in sales, certainly as a tailor. But no, Aquascutum, like many brands like Burberry and like Dax, was a fantastic sort of pioneering British brand, built basically on outerwear and the waterproof sort of Mac and so on. As and you mentioned, over many, many decades, picked up a huge following from royal family right through to people like Cary Grant. And a lot of these businesses, I was quite surprised actually when I first went to Japan probably about nearly 20 years ago, that how strong these British brands were and how they were pioneers into those sort of markets. And it was probably because of their Britishness that a lot of people actually looked to them as benchmarks for brands to follow. But unlike Burberry, brands like Dax and Aquascutum have suffered, and possibly the difference between there is that Burberry has managed its licenses. In fact, I believe they're bringing even more of them back in-house, and I've had a very strong direction since the Rosemary Bravo years. But to be fair to Aquascutum and possibly the situation that we have with Aquascutum UK, that basically was a business outside of anything in Asia. And fundamentally, the jewel in the crown is Japan and the Asian markets. And although it might be in difficulties at the moment, I do hope that possibly their Chinese partner, YMG, I believe it is, might buy into it.
It did seem to have all the signs that it could recover, though, because if we look at last September's London Fashion Week, Joanna Sykes' designs were sent down the catwalk to great acclaim. And Harold Tillman had pumped, £30 million into Aquascutum over the last couple of years. It did have all the signs of promise. What made this one not work?
As I say, I think it's having not some of the key markets is a big problem. If you look again at Burberry, which is number one brand in Japan, it's a phenomenal size business. So you really kind of need that to fuel the rest of it. I think it's very important. And again, with Harold Tillman and the designs you talked about, it's very, very key in the sense that, you know, what they were trying to do is actually probably broadcast from London what the future of the brand could be. But without the sort of routes to market and the sort of distribution that you haven't got in Asia, it make it very difficult to develop the business. Something we talked before we came on air about, you know, you're talking about family and parents. One of the things that is missing in the British market is a brand like Aquascutum that actually appeals to generations, from the grandparents to the parents to the grandchildren. And something I was very passionate about when I was at Dax, and something I would like to have dearly delivered, is actually a very, very good classic brand. I mean, people think of classic as being very boring. It doesn't have to be dusty and old-fashioned. It can actually be rather cool. So possibly, you know, having sort of new direction and fashion is one thing, but actually the heart of a business like that probably is outerwear, jackets, slacks and so on.
So you talk about the traditional design there. Arguably Burberry started from the same doldrums as Aquascutum finds itself in, but then suddenly went completely the wrong way by selling all its licenses, which it's now in the process of trying to buy back.
Yeah.
And so Burberry has gone from being very traditional, like Aquascutum, going far too popular, yeah, and then coming back to a niche younger market. Do you think Aquascutum could do the same thing?
Possibly. I think that's exactly what happened. Again, going back to my experience going to Asia, initially a lot of these brands that we knew, their identity in our traditional markets, mainly Europe and in America, were very, very different because the licensees were basically left, as you quite rightly say, with Burberry to actually run amok, really. At the end of the day, what they wanted to do was sign licenses to actually make money. And the problem is then you lose the identity of the brand. The success of Burberry is it didn't actually happen overnight. That was, you know, a 5-year sort of program of actually getting out there something new, actually getting some noise behind it while they fix the sort of bread and butter of the business. We think of it as sort of Christopher Bailey. We think of it as Burberry Prorsum and so on. That's a very, very small part, but an extremely important part of the visibility of the brand. If you actually go to the traditional markets, you'll see they still sell the traditional Burberry check Mac, the traditional scarf and so on. That thing is still a huge part of the business, but they've managed to sort of be able to keep that and in fact improve that by actually bringing the licenses back in and controlling it, not throwing that away, but also bringing newness. The problem is it's kind of a bit back to front with the brands like Aquascutum and Dax. You've got the licensee who's basically very, very good at licensing brands, but not necessarily good at brand building. And as I said, the jewel in the crown being Asia, not having that makes it very, very difficult.
Now, we've talked about Harold Tillman, the owner, or the then owner of Aquascutum. He's had a bad week, as well as losing Aquascutum to the administrators. He's sold Jaeger to pay off debts. Jaeger, another brand, traditional English, possibly associated with the previous generation, which has fought hard in the last couple of years to try and find its niche in the sort of late 30s, early 40s market. Has it? But clearly it's failed.
I'm not sure it's failed. I think it'd be interesting to see what happens with the new investment, but they've certainly tried to do the right things. Again, it's very, very difficult difficult. I think we've also got to remember there's only so many brands that you can turn around. There's only so many room for brands there. And if you think what those brands are trying to do is almost not so much Jaeger, but possibly Aqua Scutum to try and piggyback off the success of the Burberrys. Burberry is actually one of the only sort of British brands that translates truly internationally. Of course, Sir Paul Smith is extremely successful. But in the real world, if you go to, say, places like America, Burberry's one of the only British brands that actually sort of sings. And it technically is a super brand. It is up there with the Vuittons and the Ralph Lauren's and so on. And certainly in visibility, obviously it has a different sort of arena of different product. You asked earlier whether it could be turned around. I think it still has great legs, but I think it is actually looking at not just the fashion end. I think that fundamentally it was originally a menswear brand. The casual wear market is something Aqua Scutum could do extremely well in. I also do think that classic side of things, not boring, going back to really interesting, good product could be something that would be very successful. It's a shame in a way, in this sort of Olympic year and the Diamond Jubilee, the visibility of the last couple of years and going for the next few years is all things British. Someone like Aqua Scutum does deserve to do well.
And you mentioned many times in our interview about the Asian market.
Yes.
It appears that the Hong Kong-based owner of the Aqua Scutum brand in Asia is in discussion now to try to save it. Is that the only way forward?
I don't know if it's the only way forward, but it'd probably be the best way forward because then they've got the global license for the whole brand or the global ownership.
This is why GM Trading was talking about.
Yes, yeah, and I think that would make an awful lot of sense as a brand. And maybe that's a strategic move, I don't know. I don't know the sort of business ins and outs of this, but it would make an awful lot of sense. If you think about it, brands like Gives and Hawks, which have been recently bought back by their licensee in Hong Kong, you think of brands like Kent and Kerwin, which you might not remember, used to be a kind of a cricket and sportswear brand that they launched over here, to, again, I think owned by similar people, and certainly Hong Kong Chinese business, tried to open a store in Conduit Street, made it very, very trendy. It didn't actually work very well here, but it's extremely successful again in Asia. And it's about how you actually pitch those brands to that market. Again, the underlying theme with all those brands is Britishness. And you've got to remember, particularly in Asia, they do benchmark, particularly with menswear.
Timothy Everest, thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio. That was Timothy Everest speaking about the recent woes of Aqua Scutum. You're listening to me, Dory House. In a moment, we'll be changing tack and talking about women being recruited into the Afghan army. Stay with us.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24, Hagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, yorkasa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The proper jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afternoon to Monocle 24.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And this is Midori House on Monocle 24, 9 minutes to the hour. For the first time in Afghanistan since the Taliban were ousted, the National Army is now recruiting women, but the uptake, quite understandably, is slow. Well, a new film documents the difficulties these women have, some of them too afraid even to tell their family, as they're recruited and trained. In a moment, I am joined now in the studio by the director of Afghan Army Girls, Lalagi Snow. A very warm welcome to the studio, Lalagi.
Thank you very much.
Your film, Afghan Army Girls, what prompted you to go out and film these women?
I was actually serendipitously, I was on an embed with the British forces in 2010 and stuck in an airfield in Kandahar, and got talking to a British major who happened to be working in Kabul at the military training centre and told me about the girls. And I thought, brilliant. So then I wrote about them for the Telegraph magazine, and then from there decided to try and get access to make a documentary with the backing of a production company. And it took a year to get the access from that.
I was about to say, it sounds as if you did it overnight, but it must have taken an awful long time to gain the trust, more importantly, of anybody of these women.
Yeah, it was actually gaining the trust of NATO and ISAF was one thing, and letting them know that it wasn't going to be a big, scary film crew, it's just me. And then I then made a taster tape on the second class of cadets. They do a six-month class, basically. And then won the trust, of ISAF and NATO and the Afghan MOD. And then said, look, I want to do something that follows them from beginning to end. So they said, OK, come back for class 3.
So where are these girls actually training?
They're training in Kabul at KMTC, Kabul Military Training Camp.
So they're isolated from the world?
They're isolated from the men who train in the same camp for 5 days a week. And then for the other two, they go home.
Now, when we think about Afghanistan, we think of a place which is difficult for women.
Yes.
And the army, wherever you are, has not always had the reputation for being sympathetic to women recruits. What are these women actually signing up to do? I mean, are they fighters? Are they medics?
No,
what are they?
It's baby steps. You know, it was the same when the British invited women to join, you know, our army, and the same with the Americans. So it is baby steps. They will be going to do mostly back office jobs to free up the males who are there, who can then go and do some fighting. There's also a school of thought that women are better at doing jobs like that than males are. Well, in Afghanistan it is anyway. But for the very sort of the top echelon of the cadets who graduate, they want to go to the Air Force because either they're very passionate about their country and they really want to do something to help, you know, ameliorate the situation of women and to help fight for their country, or it offers the chance for them to train abroad.
You mentioned that, you know, what drives these women. Is it, like you say, passion for them to serve their country or passion for them as women to make their mark?
Both, actually. Afghans are much more patriotic than I think we are as a nation, especially given kind of the 30 years or some, you know, over 30 years now of war. So that there is the sort of serving of their country. The other side is that some of the girls are really passionate about, you know, trying to open up the rest of the world into believing that Afghan women are better than, not better, that they can improve the situation of women. If they take the step forward now, they're setting the precedent for other women to follow them. That's what I meant to say.
So during their recruitment and training, what was their experiences like? I mean, what bits did they find easy and what bits did they struggle with?
Well, they loved the shooting and the sport. They did sport for the first time ever. So some of them didn't even know that, you know, having your heartbeat racing was normal when you do sport. You know, so they were like, oh God, I'm dying. It's like, no, you're fine. It's just your heartbeat. Loved the shooting. Weren't very good at it, but loved it. And all the kind of the first aid and the map reading. And then I think the biggest challenges were probably concentration and English. Oh, and when I was filming, it was Ramadan. So that was a kind of, you know, lessons stopped at halfway through the day, but it put a lot of pressure on them because obviously they weren't eating for 17 hours or drinking any water, so they'll squabbles and stuff.
And what was the reaction from the men on the camp?
They most of them didn't actually know they were training women there because, I mean, they are in total isolation. When they were, it's quite funny, I interviewed a couple of them that isn't in the film, but they either didn't know or were really shocked. And I did lots of sort of gauged the reception of how men would, you know, react across the city. And actually what the rumours that came out were that these girls weren't in the army to be soldiers. They were in the army to be prostitutes for soldiers, both Afghan and American. So their reputation was kind of really sullied. And in Afghanistan, reputation and honour is basically the backbone of society. The moment you're remotely called into question, that's it, you know, your family honour is called into question, your chances of marriage are ruined. So these guys are really taking this massive stride, not just forward for the future of the country, but to try and change people's minds about what it really is to be an Afghan girl.
And they're taking such risks that they don't even tell their parents that they're doing it.
One didn't. They tell most of the time, because in Afghanistan you have to basically, you're on loan to anyone. You either have to do what your father tells you until you get married, and then you become the property of your husband. So so long as they had permission from their parents, it would be okay. One girl didn't, and she snuck out, and it turns out her father was actually a chef at one of the other camps anyway, and she was sort of frog marched in front of the school commander, and then the school commander, who was very charming, said, listen, don't worry, she's okay, she's safe.
What was the reaction outside the camp to the women? Because you said that it, you know, it changes people's perception of them if they think that they're being trained up to be prostitutes and not soldiers.
Yeah, they were very mixed. You know, some people thought it was very good. You know, the bottom line, I think, from the Ministry of Defence or anyone military would be great, brilliant, look what we're doing for the country. I personally don't know if the country is ready for women in the army. It's sort of two steps forwards, two steps back all the time. And having lived there for, you know, a year and a half, as a Westerner, so as a third gender, it's a very, very difficult place to be a woman. So,
The film, I understand, hasn't quite been finished, though. What kind of conclusions are you going to draw?
It has been finished. It's just the last tweaks. The conclusion is to be left up to you as a viewer, having got to know three characters to see if the country's ready. But it's mainly really about opening up three very different characters and showing a different side of Afghan life that is normal girls being really, really normal, talking about makeup and marriage and love and the sort of things that any girl really thinks about.
Alagi Sam, thank you very much indeed. Pleasure, for joining us. And it's being premiered at the Frontline Club, isn't
Front
that right?
Frontline Club on Monday night.
We wish you the very best of luck. Thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. Pleasure. That's all for this Thursday's edition of Midori House. Today's show is produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Tony Hammond. At 2200 hours London time, you can hear The Daily. But from us on Midori House, thanks for listening. Goodbye.